Contextual presents.
Sondern wir schaffen uns unseren Staat!
Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate.
Together, we will make America great again.
Sudah cukup bagi kita untuk mengatakan bahwa winter is coming.
Back again to Podcast Bebas Aktif, the biggest IR podcast in Indonesia and presumably in Southeast Asia. Yo. Okay, so this is an unusual episode. That's a bold claim, but yes. It might be true. Okay, so this is an unusual podcast. This is an unusual episode because we are speaking English right now. So it means that we have another special episode with international guests who happens usually to be a good friend of mine. Okay, so just like usual, we will discuss about international relations from Indonesian perspective. Then, okay, this is me, Abid. And then we also have, as usual, Mr. Hafiz. How are
Hello.
You doing, bro?
Guys, welcome to Podcast Bebas Aktif. It's not unusual, it's special, Mas Abid.
It's special, yeah. Special. Definitely.
It's always been special.
Yeah, special, unusual, right?
Okay. Mas Aman, how are you doing?
Yeah, very fine. Great here. If you put all the COVID disaster outside of the radar, everything is okay.
Okay. Good. Great to hear that. Okay, so today it's a special day because we're going to talk about something that recently becomes a talking point across the world. It is a Colombian it's Colombian protest that happened since a week ago, if I'm not mistaken, and it became a global news. And then today we have a special guest who happens to be a very good friend of mine, a student of MSc in International Relations at LSE. And he's not an ordinary student because he's also the co-founder and vice president of Association for International Peace and Security at LSE. So please welcome Mr. Alejandro Posada Tellez. Welcome.
Thank you, Abid. It's really nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me, you guys. I'm just very happy to be here with you today, speaking about a topic that is close to my heart.
Oh, nice.
Coming. We really wait for this session because the news are all in the media, but we do not have enough knowledge on Colombian politics to really digging deep into what is happening in Colombia. And because in Indonesia, we also have several protests last year, a quite major, and it's pretty much so what is happening in Colombia right now resonates really much with our audience today. So I do think that they are waiting for this discussion. So thank you very much.
It's good. Well, then we need to tackle that gap then, don't we?
Definitely. Yeah. So as Masofan just told us that many Indonesian people do not have knowledge about Colombia in general. Most people, including myself, I would say that the only thing I know about Colombia is about the football. It's about James Rodriguez and all of the stuff, you know. Yeah. And then little did we know about that. Maybe Masofan, do you have any certain knowledge about Colombia?
My memory on Colombia is on the World Cup 1994, where there was a tragedy,
right?
An own goal from a Colombian player. And that player was somehow became quite famous in Indonesia and became like if you are playing in village level soccer tournament, his name was mentioned to scare the players like that.
Who is that actually? Since I obviously I wasn't even born yet.
Each card, no? I was still in elementary school, so I forgot the name.
Andres Escobar.
Yes, his name was Andres Escobar.
Yes.
That's a very hard part of our history. And to be fair, I'm very happy to hear that when you hear the word Colombia, you think of football. I mean, I know football is a big thing in Indonesia. But the thing is, for us Colombians, we've had to battle a very, very hard stereotype of, I mean, it's with good reason that we have it, stereotype of violence, of drug trafficking, of armed conflict, which is true to what has happened and to the history of Colombia. And what you're telling me, the murder of Andrés Escobar, that I believe it really reflects a bit of the hardship of Colombia's history with violence and in general with death and struggling with it. And we've had to battle that stereotype recently because things, especially since the signature of the peace agreement in 2016, things have gone for the better until now, at least. So it has certainly been a stereotype to battle and to fight, and which every day, I think, becomes more and more reinforced. And with what's happening right now, I believe more so.
Yeah. Mm. I think, Alejandro, you don't have to worry, because for Jakartans, Colombia and Bogota is also related to Transjakarta, which is the BRT of Jakarta. I think many people know that the Transjakarta was modeled from your BRT, so it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah, that's absolutely
and we're
amazing.
Sister cities, Bogota and Jakarta.
Yes,
aren't we?
That's true. Yeah.
And that's a good bridging to further the discussion or to open the discussion. So, Alejandro, please tell Indonesian audience about three things that we have to know about Colombian politics.
Yep,
only three things.
Well, I'm going to tell you about what's happening right now a little bit. The short answer, maybe if you ask me about Colombian politics right now, is convoluted. So Colombia is a country with a history of relative political stability. We are the oldest democracy in the region. We have prided ourselves that in spite of a very long-standing armed conflict, mostly in the countryside, vast levels of inequality and a big problem with drug production and drug trafficking, we have actually been one of the most stable countries in Latin America, especially in the 20th century, speaking in merely political terms, of course. But what we're seeing right now is that this same conflict that has historically taken place in the countryside and in rural areas of the country has now moved to the main cities and to the urban areas of the country, which have traditionally been more or less alienated from large scale violence. And like all of a sudden, this collective grievance of the most marginalized populations have detonated into this massive wave of social unrest. Although we'll get to the reasons behind disruption in a bit. I think that's just to put you in context. That's maybe all you need to know.
Yeah. So you mentioned about the armed conflict. So maybe a lot of people do not know what is the armed conflict you are talking about.
Well, since the 1950s, Colombia has been experiencing quite a violent armed conflict between guerrilla groups, which emerged from this wave of left wing movements and the Marxist-Leninist drive. Throughout the whole continent. The difference between what happened in Colombia and the rest of Latin America is that in Colombia, it has been much more longstanding because of one small issue, drugs. So drugs and drug production, drug trade, especially cocaine, has served to fuel the armed conflict in Colombia to levels that maybe in other countries we haven't seen. Most countries in Latin America, by the 1980s, their left-wing movements and their rebel groups, they've been either integrated into political life or completely oppressed, as maybe we saw in Peru. But in Colombia, being a rebel became a source of money, of wealth, because of the massive amounts of money that we get from cocaine trade. So I think that has been a particular detonant of social unrest and of violence in the country throughout all these decades, of course. In 2016, the government signed the peace agreement with the biggest group in the country, which was the FARC. Maybe you guys in Indonesia heard about this moment. It was massive news, massive good news in a moment where the world is convoluted. It has been for many years now. So I think this was a very good moment. A lot of optimism came from this. The agreement was very comprehensive. And right now, 5 years on, we're seeing a lot of troubles with the process. We're seeing a return to violence, both in the countryside and in urban areas. And that might help to begin explaining what is happening right now and the news that you're seeing of the social unrest and protests.
Okay. I think that's an interesting story from the situation in Colombia. I mean, with the drug situations, with the social unrest, and also, of course, the latest mass protests that's happening in Colombia. But if I ask you, what is one thing or what is a few things that will differentiate Colombia from the rest of the Latin America, what would that be? Do you have any option? I mean, whether it is the democracy or whether it is the majority of the people, the political compass, anything you can tell us.
Well, I'll give you two things that differentiate Colombia to the rest of the continent. Well, first, what I spoke about already, drugs. Other countries have their have big levels of drug production, like Peru, Bolivia, but not at the level of Colombia. Colombia currently exports, I think it's 85% of worldwide cocaine, which and think of the amount of money that and the amount of dollars that come from this. And this is not a new trend. This, I mean, you've probably heard of Pablo Escobar. This is something that has been going on for years, and it's at an all-time high right now. And the second thing that I think differentiates Colombia to other countries is the influence that the United States wields on internal political affairs of the country. Colombia is a strategic partner for the US, and they have been adamant in keeping us very close to their interests. I mean, we due to our geopolitical location, geographically, we're very, very important for the US because we're basically an entry level between Central America and the whole of South America. So for the US, its influence on the region, which is essentially its backyard, has depended to a large degree on how much influence can they wield on Colombian politics. And it's not the sort of influence that you get in other countries.
Yeah. Okay. And getting too close to a superpower is a headache, right?
And we're their biggest ally in every sense in the region, and they value us and we value them. We basically depend on them as well in every sense, in economic, political, security terms. They're our biggest partner.
Okay, but, move to the current situation in Colombia. So what is behind all of this massive demonstration? You mentioned that the shift is that all the violence that has been there for decades in the rural areas are now moving into urban areas, to central areas, and all the grievances are exploding right now. So what detonates that grievances?
Yeah, well, there is one factor which you've probably heard about that detonated the protests in the first place, which was a tax reform promoted by the current government of Colombia. So what the tax reform wanted to do, it was a much needed solution to a financial deficit brought mainly by the pandemic. So this was an attempt by the government to raise additional revenue. And they proposed to remove many of the tax exemptions that were in place until now. So basic food items, pensions, and even funerary services, for instance. So these are basic needs that people simply cannot afford to pay extra for. And in addition, it lowered the threshold for income tax payments. So even though this tax reform was, first of all, very necessary, and it was meant to hit the wealthiest part of the population the hardest, ultimately, the costs imposed to Colombia's middle and working class were completely unaffordable. Mm. So this caused people to take it to the streets in the first place. However, it would be a mistake to believe that the collective action that we're seeing right now is simply because of the tax reforms. Keep in mind that the proposal has now been withdrawn. It was withdrawn a few days ago. Yep. But people are still out on the streets showing their discontent. So yes, on one hand, protests emerged as a response to the tax bill. But it quickly came to encompass many other grievances that had been accumulating for decades within the Colombian middle and working class, such as economic hardship, corruption at government level, the growing levels of violence in the aftermath of the peace agreement, which, as I was telling you before, gave Colombia massive levels of optimism and hope, and seeing the uneven implementation, the insufficient implementation of the agreement, and the levels of violence that we're now witnessing, both in the countryside and the urban areas, made people quite unhappy. In addition to what we're seeing right now, police abuse and the repression of demonstrators. So in essence, people are angry. They have the right to be with the government, with the state, with the system as a whole, because they have been continuously let down. And I think this social mobilization is a direct product. It responds directly to these socioeconomic troubles. For instance, I'm going to share with you something that strikes me a lot is that I keep reading in social media, and a sentence that people keep bringing up, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about here, is if the people come out to protest during a pandemic, it's because their government is more dangerous than the virus.
Yeah.
So
nice.
To frame things in this way, for me at least, it's extremely powerful.
Yeah, that's a very powerful quote that I think we can also apply that to Indonesia, right, Pit?
Totally agree.
You've experienced protests in the framework of the pandemic as well?
Not in the framework of the pandemic, but during the pandemic. And I think just a few days ago, some student leaders from our university, was Abids University.
Still my university though.
was taken by the police for protesting.
Imagine the level of discontent of the people, both in Colombia and Indonesia, to go out there and protest and in the midst of a deadly pandemic. It really tells you something, doesn't it? And with this, I'm not trying at all to justify the acts of violence that we've seen on both sides. First, on behalf of the demonstrators that have been constant in the last couple of weeks. Cities have been vandalized. The infrastructure, public transport have been destroyed, have been badly damaged. Countless policemen, for instance, have also been injured by demonstrators, with one member of the police actually sadly passing away last week, being killed by protesters. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we have alarming levels of state violence. So currently in 10 days or 12 days of protests, over 30 demonstrators have now been killed by authorities. And this is not rumors. This is things that have been confirmed by the United Nations, by different NGOs, Amnesty International, and so on. There have been 800 arbitrary detentions that have been reported so far. And there have even been, don't ask me how, 9 victims of sexual violence from police forces in the midst of the protests. So this is unacceptable. This is, from both sides, the levels of violence are terrible. But in my view, you cannot really compare throwing stones, vandalizing or damaging public infrastructure with using lethal weapons against demonstrators. And I think here the government, the Duque government, has made a big mistake in failing to condemn this police violence, as the discourse that they have promoted has been one of full support for the authorities. And as you might imagine, this repressive response from the state and from the national authorities, of course, has only added wood to the fire. And it has made the resolution of this crisis more and more difficult and completely uncertain.
But I heard that President Duque also called for a national dialogue on May the 10th. Would that...
Yeah, he did. The problem I see with that, he did, actually, that was 2 days ago. He invited certain political parties. He even invited a youth movement. However, if you ask me, it's too late. It's too late. It's been 10 or 11 days of police brutality that he has failed to condemn. And he has failed to say, you know what, this is wrong, and we're going to prosecute this policeman that have been acting wrong. Actually, what he has done has been quite the contrary. Full support for the armed forces of this country. The whole weight of the law is going to fall on whoever is protesting and vandalizing the cities and being violent. So this is, no violence is acceptable. And let me be very clear that I reject any sort of violence. But as the as a president and as the head of a state, you do have a responsibility to at least try to calm the people down if they're unhappy. You can't, the government can only do too much, you know? The government can't just say, okay, we're going to take everyone out of poverty right now. We're going to, whoever's been marginalized, we're going to listen to them. You're going to get a voice. No, it's very, very difficult, especially in a country like this one. But you can at least try to pacify with your discourse and the rhetoric that you're promoting. And that's where I think the government has failed the most with its people. And that's what's been fueling further and further protests, even though the tax reform has now been removed.
Yeah. So the proposal is removed and the president is already calling for a national dialogue, but all of it are too late because now
people are enraged.
Yeah, all the grievances are already exploding. So
yeah, and one of the things
so do you see any way to de-escalate the tension, or do you think it is going to be a zero-sum game?
I think what the president is doing right now is what he should have done from the beginning. Like, okay, I'm your president, I represent you, I'm listening. But what he said since the beginning was, no, we need this tax reform. I don't care if you're happy or unhappy. I'm going to do it. So we're not going to take it off. And then when we started to see police brutality, which is one of the things that people are the angriest about, he continued to promote this militaristic discourse, which the current government has promoted very, very problematically. So what he's doing right now is trying to mend that, which I think are good steps to take. And hopefully this is a sustained effort. Hopefully people get to see, okay, he has backed down. He's been rethinking his approach and his discourse and his policies. And that might eventually help things to settle down. But right now, what I see is very worrying. And I'm quite concerned about the future of Colombia right now.
Ale, did it surprise you when it comes to President Duque's gesture to be like that? Because if I'm not mistaken, a few years ago, like international community tend to welcome him because, he is internationally friendly, I suppose. He speaks perfect English. He went to the many international interviews, and then the reaction was kind of good.
Does he also get a magazine cover, A New Hope? Huh? Indonesian joke.
Well, I think it was about time that he changed that discourse a little bit. But I'm going to tell you where that comes from. I cannot tell you if that's something that he means from the heart or if it's simply a response to pressures both domestically and internationally. The role of the international civil society and the internet and governments from around the world has been crucial here because this has been in news outlets all around the world. People are concerned, NGOs are, so everyone's eyes are currently in Colombia. And people are worried. People are worried because in our current liberal system, police brutality is condemned. We saw it with the Black Lives Matter movement in the US. The resonance that police brutality and abuse had around the world was incredible. I think that's a wonderful thing that people are worried about what happens even if it's in the other end of the world. So imagine you're the president of Colombia and you see that governments, NGOs, international organizations, they're condemning everything that you're doing. They're condemning your state, your actions. You have to back down sooner or later. So I think the role of the international community here has been pivotal in producing a change, at least in the discourse.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to reflect on Indonesia because, Colombia and Indonesia are both global south countries in which democracy is something that we still need to maintain in the both sides of the world. And I think it's very interesting to see that there is a concern about police brutality. There is a concern about how the government tends to be, not listening to what people want. So, Masovan, what do you think? What kind of reflection that we can take from Colombia?
You're putting me on But actually, it's safer here. I mean, I like a discussion in English because the cyber patrol it could not really catch up with the discussion.
Hopefully.
Yeah, but so I think a lot of parallels here between Colombia and Indonesia. So sister city or sister country is not only a terminology. I think a lot of parallels here, as you mentioned, the willingness of people to go to the street shows that even pandemic is not scary enough to keep people at home because they are so angry about what they see with the performance of the government. So I think a lot of parallels here. First, if we look at the number of the at the number of the COVID numbers, the number of cases, the number of deaths, I think we are hovering at around the same number, around 2 million cases in Colombia, around 1.7, 1.8 cases in Indonesia. And the economic impact has also been quite significant. And amidst that situation, the government finance is bleeding. The government lost a lot of its budget because of they have to rearrange the budget for COVID management, and those trying to introduce new measures to get more money from to finance different programs. And I think the tax hike in Colombia and the proposed tax hike in Colombia and several policies introduced in Indonesia was quite similar in that sense. We, I mean, like this month, the civil servants were also protesting because their wage was cut. I mean, like usually every year during the Eid al-Fitri holiday, people get their holiday wage from their employees and also their employers and also from the government. But now the civil servants only get a small portion from that because the government takes the money for financing a lot of programs. So I think a lot of parallels there. The government is struggling against the pandemic, but also at the same time showing little common sense in handling the pandemic. I mean, like they prefer to let the poorest and the weakest to bear the brunt of the pandemic while protecting those with good connections. I mean, even amidst the pandemic, government push to kill one of the most important hope in Indonesian politics, which is the anti-corruption commission. So It has been also a tough year for
Indonesia. And it's an extremely difficult position for a government. I do really sympathize with what's happening with the COVID-19 pandemic in both the Indonesian government and the Colombian government. Because we have to remember that in both these countries, institutional capabilities are limited. So there is only too much that a government can do to first control a pandemic and to control the economic costs of it and who bears the burden. In Colombia, at least, I would say, and you'll tell me if this is similar to the Indonesian experience, from a public health perspective, the government has generally acted quite well. They have issued strict policies to limit the spread of the virus, such as lockdowns, curfews, and the sort. And we actually had one of the longest lockdowns in the world this year. And these measures have not quite managed to stop cases and deaths from soaring quite high. Particularly in this third wave that we're experiencing with 17,000, 18,000 cases a day.
You're already on third wave. We are on this still on the first wave.
Well, let's hope that vaccinations go to plan, you know, because people here, at least, they have also shown their discontent with the national vaccination plan, which I think has gone quite well in comparison to many other countries. But in the end, we were one of the last countries in South America to receive vaccines. People were not happy about that. And yeah, generally, the vaccination rate has not been too efficient. But in my view, the real merit that the government has had here has been that the national health system has not collapsed. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you really see the value of first, the health system, and second, the government response. But then when we move beyond the public health perspective and we focus on the economic costs of these measures, they have been devastating for most of the Colombian population. And this, again, is a key factor to understand the current crisis. Because consider that the bulk of Colombians lives in some sort of multidimensional poverty, which I know for a fact that Indonesia struggles with as well. So these COVID measures have had a tremendously negative impact on people who, even before the pandemic, already experienced sustained economic hardship. And just to give you an idea very quickly, nearly 3 million people fell into extreme poverty in the last year. Keep in mind that Colombia has a population of 50 million people as opposed to 250 million. So in Indonesia, I can only begin to imagine how many people have fallen into extreme poverty or simply some sort of multidimensional poverty in the last year.
Yep. It has been challenging, but I think, the government response to the pandemic in Colombia is quite well, as you mentioned, right? The complexity of the problem and the out-of-touch approach, which could not really empathize with what is felt by the larger population, lead to this situation, which has quite many similarities with Indonesia, but I have to say that Colombian government is more responsible in the pandemic handling. we will keep that on another discussion. But back to Hafiz, the boss.
I think the question will be for me to understand more about the situation in Colombia is, how can we actually compare it to the Indonesia's government situation? Because here's the thing, Alejandro, if Abid has never mentioned it, but I think here we don't really have certain, different rigid ideologies. We don't really have that here. We have parties with similar ideologies from all over. You can say the left, you can say the right, but it's not actually that different. So the situation with the Colombian government, I would really want to know whether those kind of Western liberal division of political spectrum can be applied to in understanding more about the response and about the government of Colombia in general. Can we understand that in the Western political spectrum sense, or is it similar to Indonesia, in which the government or in which the ruling classes, ruling elites, they consolidate and they don't really care much about the ideologies of those.
So the point about Hafiz's question is he's wondering whether the government is right wing or left wing.
No. That's actually a bit because I've been doing some reading, Ren. That's actually unique because there are media outlets that say Duque is, extreme center, or some says that he's a right wing populist, a young right wing populist. But the steps that he has taken, like introducing more taxes, strict lockdowns, I think it's not really right wing in that Western sense, right? So that's what I want to know actually.
Yeah, I actually understand the nuances behind your question. So what's super important to understand here about Colombian politics is that historically, Colombia has been a fundamentally right-wing country. In fact, we have never had a left-wing government. And of course, this is our close proximity with the US has made us a country completely and fundamentally driven by neoliberal ideals. And I think what we're seeing now in terms of the police brutality and the levels of repression to peaceful and even and violent to protests has been within this framework of response of a neoliberal order trying to sustain itself. However, in recent years, we have seen the rise of the left in both civil society and in the political sphere. And today, I'm going to tell you, electoral polls are telling us that the next president of Colombia is most likely to be a socialist candidate, who is right now immensely popular. And this would be a massive paradigmatic shift in Colombian politics, because this is unprecedented what we're seeing right now. And the way I see it, this change is probably due to the growing discontent among the poorer segments of the population with a system that has continuously failed them, this neoliberal system. Yeah, and in recent years, left-wing parties have become quite active players of Colombian politics, acting as a strong opposition force. And the socialist candidate that I was telling you about, he's more and more influential every day. And he has become, let me tell you, a rock in the shoe for the government. Although this is, as I'm telling you, a relatively new trend.
Okay. But then the question would be, if this, next socialist president might have a chance in the presidential election, what's the change that he's going to take? Because the tax reforms, it is left-wing, right? I mean, in that sense, in that Western sense, what is the difference would be? What are the differences, if there are many of it?
Yeah, well, I'm not too sure I can answer that as of now, because we just don't know how a left-wing government would behave in a country like Colombia. We have never seen it. We don't have any experience. Mm-hmm. We have no historical sources to look to say, okay, this is what it might be like. I'd actually disagree with the fact that tax reforms can be placed within a particular spectrum of political views, because this was something that was absolutely necessary. And actually the right-wing governments of Colombia throughout history, they've been very lenient with the big enterprises, the big companies, the private sector in general. They've been given quite a few tax breaks. And what this tax reform tells me is that the government still doesn't want to tax these big enterprises, but they actually want to impose certain costs on the middle class, the working class, who is facing hardships every day, by taxing basic products, basic food, even what I was telling you, funerary services. I mean, how is this coherent with a country that is in poverty and with the pandemic, which has hit it quite hardly?
Yeah. So the tax is not for the big companies, but for the middle class and the working class. Will mostly hit them. That's why.
Yeah, initially it was supposed to hit hardest on the wealthiest segments of the population, but for individuals, and the treatment to MNCs and to private enterprises has been quite lenient, and they've been given tax breaks throughout history, and this reform was no exception to that rule.
So I think the situation can be understood similarly with the Greece situation back in 2008, with what Yanis Varoufakis has stated about the left wing and the right wing situations. In my understanding, with Alexis Tsipras and the Yanis Varoufakis party, I forgot who's the leader from the socialist parties too. So I think that's not really similar with Indonesia, but it's an interesting shift, and I would love to see it. I mean, how it unfolds. Let's just see how it unfolds, right? First of all, let's just see how it unfolds. I mean, I wish the best for Colombia, of course. But, it's a different situation in Latin America, and one Southeast Asian man cannot really have a much say about that, especially one that doesn't really research more. But I think in that sense, if if it's necessary and if it's still in under democratic umbrella, I think I'm going to be fine with that.
I think it's also fascinating to see how Colombia persists and insists with the neoliberal ideas, knowing that most of the neighbors there are leftists or do have some left.
Bolivarian
Republic. You know what? The interview that I watched the President Duque with FT, the Financial Times, he called out President Maduro as a dictator. So I think it's really interesting to see how Colombia is doing there.
Yeah, and the paradox is the Venezuelan government has now been calling out the Colombian government for human rights abuses. So it's like, seriously, are we being serious about this?
I'm also fascinated with the Colombian situation. What has been happening in Venezuela for the past few years, but I think that's for another discussion because it's going to be long, of course, right?
I think the highlight would be the reflection that we can take from Colombian case for Indonesia is that the pandemic has exposed and increase the existing inequalities in the society, and these inequalities becoming so visible that people are no longer tolerated, and people are protesting it with different ways. And at the same time, the powerful elites are quite detached from this situation and responding based merely on technocratic calculation on the budgeting, on how to allocate budget, how to get more financial sources, without being empathetic to this large part of the society which has been affected by this situation. So I think
Also, Shofan, a key parallel, now that you mentioned that I feel can be drawn, and this is mostly, I think, a lesson for the rest of the world and good for democratic values, is that state violence due to the reach and the resonance of social media and major news networks will rarely go unpunished now and unnoticed, because previously you could just, what we're seeing in Myanmar is extremely worrying, that social media has been cut off so that people cannot denounce state violence and state abuse. But in general, in countries like ours, I think the people need to realize the power that they have in social media. And in sharing and denouncing what is happening and showing the world what I was telling you before. One of the main shifts in the discourse by the president of Colombia has been caused by this massive international pressure. I really, really believe that. It's made us visible. It's made the whole situation visible. It will. They cannot afford for these levels of state violence to go unpunished, and that's. That's an optimistic final note I'd like to share.
So, people of Colombia and people of Indonesia and people of everywhere, keep your voice in the social media. Keep the resistance. Keep the resistance. Keep saying. keep saying the what you want to say, and don't be afraid of the cyber patrol a bit.
true, definitely. I think it's very necessary to always extend our solidarity to humanity, to many human rights cases all over the world, and also
To be clear, we are also protecting all violence from all sides, and we do hope that peace return to Colombia, Mas Alejandro, and we do hope that the situation will be getting better and better, hopefully in Colombia and in Indonesia.
Thank you. Yes, same. The solidarity of the people of Colombia also goes out to the people of Indonesia.
Okay, I think to close this podcast, to end this podcast, I think we would like to have book suggestions from Alejandro to understand more about the situation, perhaps in Colombia, or perhaps understanding the history of politics, the history of economic, political, or societal history in Colombia. Do you have any?
Yes. So I've got, I can think of three very, very important books that I'd really suggest for anyone who is interested in Colombia and the wider Latin America even. So for a concise and very vivid summary of Colombian history and politics, I highly recommend a book by David Bushnell called The Making of Modern Colombia, A Nation in Spite of Itself. Then to delve into Colombia's recent history, which might help us to really grasp and understand the current crisis and also Colombia's prospect for the future, I suggest Tom Failing's book, Short Walks from Bogota, Journeys in the New Colombia. And of course, it couldn't 100 Years of Solitude by Gabriel García Márquez is a must read for anyone interested in the country or the wider region.
Actually, it's quite popular, right?
I was almost disappointed that if you do not mention that.
Good, you mentioned that. That's so cool. I think because
it was translated frequently in Indonesia. I'm not really sure it was legally translated. It was, I guess it was illegally translated by several publishers.
In the past, now it is there in the market.
I think, to complement those readings, Alejandro, do you have any social media, Twitter, Instagram, anything that can be followed by the Indonesian students perhaps, or even Indonesian in general?
Yes, actually, I mean, one of the main sources of credible information, and especially if you've got an orientation for human rights. And so I'd say the main NGOs that you can think about, Amnesty International has been fantastic in their coverage of this. I'd say most of the international media outlets, the BBC, the New York Times, they've been following the situation quite closely and in a very accurate manner. So I wouldn't go too far and would just say stick to those.
Okay, that's cool. Thank you so much, Alejandro, Mas Alejandro, if I might say, to join our podcast to discuss and to give insights about the Colombian politics. And of course, I hope also that peace come to the whole region of Latin America, not only to Colombia, but especially, of course, to Colombia. Mas Abid, do you have anything to say?
No, I think it's enough, and I think it's been a fascinating discussion. So thank you very much. Muchas gracias, hermano.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you guys for inviting me. It really has been a pleasure and a privilege to speak to you guys today.
Yeah. Okay. That's it from us. Mas Abid, do you want to close it or me?
yeah. Okay, don't forget to follow our social media and then subscribe to our YouTube as well as our Spotify as well. So please stay healthy, everyone, and see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you so much.
Nice.